chapter 24 through 27 tonight, four chapters. I hated to stop last time because we stopped right in the middle of one of Job's speeches. We're going to have to do it again because chapter 27 is the beginning of Job's last speech, and it's about six chapters long. So obviously there's going to have to be some place in there that we break. Once again, if there was any way that we could do this the way that it happened, where we could study all 35 middle chapters at once, because they're basically one conversation that took place in probably a day or less. But when we can only do a few chapters at a time, then you kind of lose the context of, well, what did that guy just say that Job's answering now? And you kind of lose that flow, and I don't really know a better way to do it. Even guys that are much better teachers than me have the same trouble. It seems repetitious at first glance, and I know that I got ripped off a lot of the beauty in the book of Job because I prejudged it without actually having read the whole thing and thought about it and pondered it. And so I've been enjoying this study. I'm digging nuggets out every week. The last thing that we heard Job say in chapter 23, he's reiterated because he had just gone through Eliphaz's last speech, which was an attack, and then he gave an altar call. He basically said, okay, we all know you're a sinner. You just won't admit it. And then he lays out this, basically what my church I grew up in would be called an altar call, where he says, okay, you need to make a decision here and you need to admit that you're wrong. It's important that we understand that because some of the things Job is going to say in the passage we're looking at tonight are dealing directly with that kind of pressure. What we saw Job do last time was he said, look, I don't know why God's not showing up. I don't know. He's the only one that really knows the truth. You guys don't know anything about what's going on. All of your accusations against me are wrong. Your whole theory about the reason the bad stuff happened is because of sin, and that only bad stuff only happens to bad people. He said, that's just bogus. And chapter 21, he laid out the reasons why that was bogus. He said, look around. Do you see anybody who's wicked that has had all of this stuff happen to them that happened to me? And in chapter 21, he says, you know, if you look around and ask the men on the street, they'll tell you, heck no. Wicked people live long, happy lives and watch their children's children and, you know, get or die fat and happy. So he said, you know, your theory doesn't make sense. It's not proven by the evidence. And then he says in chapter 23, what I really wish is that I wish I could just meet before God in his court and present my evidence. And I love verses 10, 11, and 12 of chapter 23. He says, you know, I can't see God right now, but he can see me. He knows the way that I take, and meaning that God knows every step that I take. He's known it through my whole life. I couldn't hide from him if I tried to. And he said, when he has tested me, my New King James Bible says, boy, I don't sound nearly as fabulous without reverb, do I? I sounded like Charlton Heston with reverb. When he's tested me, I shall come forth as gold. That's misleading because the word is the word tested that the New King James translates this Hebrew word is the word for being examined. And so it follows the thought that he's saying, if I could just stand before God and present my evidence, he's known me my whole life. He knows whether I'm a hypocrite, whether I'm trying to hide sin. He knows I'm not doing that. He knows I've kept my accounts straight with him. And I know that if he examined me, I would come forth as gold. This is Job speaking of being justified. And I don't know if you remember the word that we looked at translated justified. The New King James translates it righteous a couple of times, and that's a misleading translation. The Hebrew word is the word tzaddik, which is spelled T-S-A-D-H-E-Q, tzaddik. It means to be proven morally right by forensic means. It's a legal term. It means that you present evidence for your case that exonerates you and justifies you. God is the one that justifies, but God hears the evidence and makes his decision based on the evidence. And Job said, that's all I want. I just want for God to examine me, to, you know, just face to face, let me present this because I know how it's going to turn out because he knows me. Verse 11 says, my foot has held fast to his steps. I have kept his way. I've not turned aside. I have not departed from the commandment of his lips because I have treasured the words of his mouth more than my necessary food. That's one of my favorite verses in the Bible. Now, it's one thing for a guy to say that. It's another thing for God to agree with him. And that's Job's whole case. Of course, Job doesn't know chapter 1 and chapter 2 what's happening. Job doesn't know that he's not on trial. He's the star witness. God is on trial. Satan is the accuser. What's at stake is God trustworthy? Would Job continue to trust God despite what Satan would do to him? So God is really the one that's on trial. Job doesn't know that yet. When we get over to chapter 29, we're going to hear from Job's mouth what God says in a nutshell. Job is going to, he does it in a way to defend himself against the charges that he was a crook. He took advantage of poor people. That's why he was rich, which we know is not true because we know he was rich because God blessed him. And God himself says, this is an upright man. This is a man who's blameless. In chapter 29, Job describes what his life has been like. Once again, it would be arrogance if it was just his opinion. It would be arrogance if it was boasting, but God agrees with him. And so keep that in mind because we're going to see that word justified, tzedek, a couple of times in the next couple of chapters. So let's wade right in. We did this last night in 15 minutes less than what I have here, so I think it can be done if I will confine my comments, which you know I never do. The last thing we heard Job say, by the way, the chapters and verses were not originally in this, and this is one of those places where I think that the chapter designation fell in the wrong place. I think that verse 1 of chapter 24 should go at the end of chapter 23. It's all one speech anyway. But the last thing that we saw Job say was, look, God can do whatever he wants. Who's going to fight him? He said, and he's already appointed my ways for me. So, I mean, I'm not going to stop God from unfolding his plan. But Job says, here's the thing that's troubling to me. Why didn't he just let me die before all this horrible happened? Why did I have to see all of this horror? And that doesn't jive with what he knows about God. Well, we're going to find out that the story is not over. By the way, keep in mind also that Job thinks he's dying. He thinks he's just got a short amount of time. He doesn't know that in less than 24 hours, his whole life is going to completely change. And he's going to live to a ripe old age, what it says in chapter 42, old and full of years. 140 more years he's going to live with great blessing. So do not let Satan predict your future, especially if you're just depressed, because he's a liar and he doesn't know your future. So at the end of that statement about I don't get it, God, you know, does whatever he wants, I can't fight him and I'm not arguing with him, but I just it troubles me that he didn't let me die. I wasn't cut off before all this horrible stuff happened. Continuing in that thought, since times are not, by the way, Hebrew poetry is just hard to translate into English, even for smart people, which I'm not one. Since times are not hidden from the Almighty, why do those who acknowledge him not see his days? And that's the word for days of justice. Let me reread that as best I could translate it, since God sees everything at all times, since he's not waiting for further information to make his judgment, I mean, he sees it while it's going down. He says, I just don't understand why those of us that acknowledge him don't get to see justice. Why don't we see with our own eyes justice? And that's kind of the theme of the next few chapters. And it's a good question. In chapter 24, Job is going to talk about exploitation of the poor and needy by wicked people. And the more he talks about it, the more upset he gets. And, of course, the more he talks about it, the more upset we get. But he does come to some good conclusions. And if you take it in the context of the statements that they've been making, the sudden calamity that came on Job was because, you know, God will only let the wicked go so long, and then he'll just jerk the rug out from underneath them, and that's your problem, Job. You're wicked, and you just won't admit it. And he says, you know, that's just not the facts. It's not the way things are, which is the title of our study tonight. So, defending himself obliquely, starting at verse 2, remember, they had accused him of being a person who stole property by just cheating with the registration and the landmarks, and then he foreclosed on poor widows, and he demanded money from people, and that's how he got rich. That was their accusation. So he says, some remove landmarks. Parenthetically, you should say, but not me. They seize flocks violently and feed on them. He's saying, I'm not guilty of this, but there is exploitation and injustice in this world, and it's troubling. They, that is speaking of the wicked, they drive away the donkey of the fatherless. They take the widow's ox as a pledge. Remember, the Israelites were not allowed to take collateral when they made a loan. They weren't allowed to charge interest, which I think is kind of interesting how far off that we are. They, that is the wicked, push the needy off the road. All the poor of the land are forced to hide. Indeed, like wild donkeys in the desert, they, that is the poor, go out to their work searching for food. The wilderness yields food for them and for their children, and they gather their fodder in the field and glean in the vineyard of the wicked and spend the night naked without clothing. Have no covering in the cold. They're wet with the showers of the mountains and huddle around the rock for want of shelter. Some, speaking once again of the wicked, some wicked people snatch the fatherless right from the breast and take a pledge from the poor. Notice how many times that's repeated in here as being a really bad thing. People don't bat an eyelash these days, but they, that is the wicked, cause the poor to go naked without clothing, and they take away the sheaves from the hungry. They, that is the hungry, press out oil within their walls, they're speaking of the wicked. In other words, the poor and needy are the ones doing all the work. They're the ones stomping out the oil and the grapes, and yet they suffer thirst. Exploitation. The dying groan in the city, and the souls of the wounded cry out, and yet God does not charge them with wrong. And I think you should write in the word yet, because that's kind of the point of everything that Job is saying in his protestations about there being a lack of immediate justice. And the reason he's saying it is because, once again, he's been accused of being a wicked person, and that's why the carpet was jerked out from underneath him. And he's saying, if that's the way God always does things, what about all these guys? God hasn't jerked the carpet out from underneath them. And it's obvious what they're doing. Verse 13, these, that is the wicked, are those who rebel against the light. They don't know its ways, nor abide in its paths. The murderer rises with the light, gets up early, kills the poor and the needy, and in the night he's like a thief. The eye of the adulterer waits for twilight, saying, no eye will see me. And he disguises his face. And in the dark, they break into houses which they marked for themselves in the daytime. In other words, premeditated theft. They don't know the daylight, for the morning is the same to them as the shadow of death. Speaking of criminals, they do what they do in the dark. They hate the light. If someone recognizes them, they are in the terrors of the shadow of death. So that's the nature of the violence and the exploitation in the world, which God apparently, Job is saying, is not judging the way you say he always does. Listen to verses 18, 19, and 20. They should be swift on the face of the waters, which is a euphemism for being washed away in a flash flood. They should be. Their portion should be cursed in the earth so that no one would turn into the way of their vineyards. In other words, if God was going to give justice for no other reason than to punish these guys so nobody would wander into their sphere of influence. As drought and heat consume the snow water, so the grave consumes those who have sinned. Eventually should be written in there. The womb should forget him, that is the wicked man. The worm should feed sweetly on him. Something about that phrase it's poetry, but it's nasty poetry. Yes, may the worms feed sweetly upon, I can't even say it. May the worms feed sweetly upon you. He should be remembered no more. And wickedness should be broken like a tree, because he preys on the barren who do not bear, and he does no good for the widow. I don't think we'll be able to do it, but if we could hold all of these things that he's saying are things that he's been accused of indirectly and sometimes overtly. And when we get to chapter 29, Job's going to tell the story of his life, and he did exactly the opposite of all of these things. He took care of widows. He helped the needy. People who were in trouble ran to him. And so this is just part of his closing remarks for the last few chapters, and I'm sorry that we have to do it in chunks. Verse 22 is totally messed up in the New King James. The Amplified Bible nails it, so I'm going to read what the Amplified says. And I looked every single word up just to be sure. It says, yet God prolongs the life of the wicked mighty, that is the mighty wicked man, the powerful wicked man, by his power. They rise up when they had despaired of life. In other words, here I am, I'm dying, I'm a good guy. God doesn't cut these guys off. Here I am thinking my days are almost over, and God seems to prolong their lives. Verse 23, he gives them security and they rest on it. Yet, and always look for the yet and the buts, because those are pivotal points. He says, yeah, it looks like justice is being ignored, but the story's not over. Yet his eyes are on their ways. They are exalted for a little while, but then they're gone. They are brought low. They are taken out of the way like all others. They dry out like the heads of grain. Now, if this is not so, who will prove me a liar and make my speech worth nothing? Now, if you took chapter 24, which we just read, and chapter 21, which says many of the same things, and took them together and sandwiched Eliphaz's altar call, which basically he didn't even answer Job's arguments against their philosophy. All three of these guys had the same erroneous philosophy about the way God does things. But he never considers it. Eliphaz doesn't. And I think Job's pretty eloquent in his rebuttal and saying, look, look around. You don't see the thing that you say, that bad stuff only happens to bad people. You don't see that in the real world. Judgment isn't about God jerking the rug out from under somebody the first time they sin. Judgment will come. That's the point that Job is making. The other point that he's making is you can't judge me based on these events and say it's the way God always does things with wicked people. He just says it can't be proven in the real world. Besides, Job says, I'm innocent. God knows it. I know it. And I don't know what your problem is, but it just doesn't hold water. So I think Job's presented a really good case against their case. Bildad, this is his last speech. He was very scathing in the one that the last time he talked and told Job he probably was way worse of a sinner than even they imagined. Bildad, after Job's rebuttal, doesn't really address it at all. He kind of ignores it. And chapter 25 is only 6 verses long. It's sort of sandwiched in. If you could picture these guys all sitting around in a circle, having a conversation in a very animated way. Remember the marketplace in Jerusalem? You see a group of people anywhere gathered together in Jerusalem, they are not whispering. They have very heated arguments. They scream at times, and they get up, and they throw stuff, and they wave their arms around. It's pretty cool. It's pretty interesting. That they could just be talking about the weather. It's just the way that they debate. So you have to add that scene into these 35 chapters in the middle. These three guys are bent on making Job feel guilty. It's not easy to do for anybody. Usually when we think we're going to make somebody feel guilty, all they do is they justify themselves. So it always backfires. I think it's just a waste of energy. But in Job's case, not only did it backfire, but he wasn't guilty to begin with. All it did was make him want to talk to God even more. So they didn't accomplish what they wanted to. I wanted to add something. You can write it in if you want to, if you do cross references. At the end of chapter 24, when he says, look, it looks like they're getting away with it. I know it looks like the exploiters and the violent criminals, it looks like they're getting away with it, but God sees everything they're doing. And if they are prospering, it's only going to be for a while. They are going to face their judge. It is troubling, though, isn't it, to see injustice? So right in, at the end of chapter 24, 2 Peter 3, verses 8 and 9, I want to read it to you just because it saved me from going nuts a few times when it looks like the bad guys are winning. Peter's talking about injustice, the fact that God doesn't judge the people that are exploiting godly people. He does not judge them right away, that's what I thought of when I read what Job said, because that's been a problem for a long time. For some people say, God, I don't get it. We're on your side. But let me read verses 8 and 9. Where Peter's talking about this. I'm reading from the Amplified Bible. He says, nevertheless, do not let this one fact escape you, beloved, that with the Lord, one day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day. The Lord does not delay and is not tardy or slow about what he promises. And once again, we're in the context, we're speaking of judgment. He's not slow or tardy or late about what he promises, according to some people's conception of slowness. But he is long-suffering, extraordinarily patient toward you, not desiring that any should perish, but that all should turn to repentance.